Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, who discusses the deep-rooted ethnic divisions in Syria, which have provoked an uprising against the regime of Bashar al-Assad. Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who talks about why she opposes the use of U.S. Predator drones in targeted assassinations in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And Dr. Kevin Trenberg of the National Center for Atmospheric Research, who explains why he believes the increasing frequency of extreme weather events across the globe are related to climate change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The government of Bahrain has charged dozens of doctors and nurses with aiding anti-government protesters. The doctors rejected the charges, saying they have an obligation to treat everyone who seeks medical attention. The charges against medical staff are part of a severe crackdown against the Persian Gulf country's Shiite majority, who had led pro-democracy protests against the regime of King Mahmoud Isa al-Khalifa, who is a Sunni Muslim. In mid-March, al-Khalifa declared a state of emergency and invited in troops from Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states to help crush the protests. In recent weeks, opposition leaders were arrested and a major Shiite newspaper closed. Human Rights Watch estimates over 1,000 people have been arrested in Bahrain since the protests started in February. Physicians for Human Rights say doctors were abducted from their homes and handcuffed by security officers. Since the pro-democracy protests started in February, more than 30 people have been killed, including 4 opposition activists who died in police custody. Physicians for Human Rights claims the government troops have used excessive force against protesters, including high-velocity weapons, shotguns, chemical agents, and torture. Bahrain is home to the U.S. Navy's 5th Fleet, a key military outpost in the Gulf region. Human rights groups are troubled that the Obama administration has remained silent on the Bahrain crackdown. After the end of the Cold War, U.S. policymakers embraced a plan to convert weapons-grade plutonium into fuel for commercial nuclear reactors. However, construction on the fuel conversion plant in South Carolina has been marred by delays and major cost overruns. Now concern is rising about the safety of the mixed oxide fuel, or MOX, plant that is slated to open in 2016 at a cost of $5 billion to taxpayers, which is 4 times the original cost. 2 chemical engineers who inspected the plant have left the Nuclear Regulatory Commission over design and safety issues. They say that the NRC took shortcuts to avoid more construction delays. They cite the potential for chemical explosions at the MOX plant and the risk of the release of radioactive material. According to ProPublica, former NRC chemical engineer Alex Murray is worried about the potential for red oil explosions at the MOX plant. Such explosions have long been a risk at nuclear weapons facilities. The worst red oil explosion occurred in 1993 at a plant in Tomsk, Russia, which destroyed part of the building and sent out a radioactive plume into the local community. The MOX plant in South Carolina sits on an earthquake fault line, but is not considered as vulnerable as the nuclear plants in Japan. Since the 1990s, the use of DNA evidence in courtrooms has led to the release of hundreds of convicted prisoners. Yet the Supreme Court has continually protected prosecutors from having to release evidence that could allow inmates to prove their innocence. In the latest case, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a split 5-4 decision, overturned a $14 million jury verdict for Louisiana resident John Thompson, who spent 14 years on death row for a crime he did not commit. The decision protected the New Orleans district attorney from being sued for errors that led to an innocent man going to prison. In the Thompson case, at least 4 prosecutors knew of evidence such as blood tests and eyewitness reports that showed Thompson was innocent of murder charges. In a separate opinion in the case, Justice Antonin Scalia claimed prosecutors have no constitutional duty to turn over test results that may free a convicted prisoner. Scalia cited the case of an innocent Arizona man, Larry Youngblood, who was convicted of rape. A state appeals court overturned his conviction because the police had destroyed evidence in the case. In the early 1990s, the Supreme Court reimposed the rape conviction, saying the prosecutors had no duty to turn over the evidence to the defendant. In 2000, Tucson police used a sophisticated DNA test on Youngblood. The evidence pointed to another perpetrator, Walter Cruz, who was already in prison in Texas for two sexual assaults against children. In a sad ending to this case, Youngblood died before he was able to receive any compensation for wrongful imprisonment. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
The popular uprisings across the Middle East and North Africa, which succeeded in ousting the governments in Tunisia and Egypt, have for the past 2 months also unexpectedly taken hold in Syria. Although Western journalists have not been permitted into Syria to report on police attacks on demonstrations, more than 850 civilians are estimated to have been killed, with at least 8,000 arrested. Syria's President Bashar al-Assad, who ordered the violent police crackdown on protesters demanding political and economic reform, has followed his predecessor's response to dissent. Bashar's father, Hafez al-Assad, who led Syria for 29 years, ordered the violent repression of members of the Muslim Brotherhood who challenged his regime in 1982. Up to 20,000 people were reported killed by the Syrian military in a massacre in the city of Hama. One of the underlying causes for conflict in Syrian society is the enormous power held by al-Assad and others in his minority Alawite religious community, a branch of Shiite Islam, comprising only 12% of the population. The 74% Sunni Muslim majority in Syria complain bitterly of deep-rooted discrimination. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and editor of the online newsletter Syria Comment. Landis discusses the ethnic divisions in Syria, which present a major obstacle to ending the violence and negotiating political and economic reforms.
President's Alawite, his brother, Maher, is in charge of the Republican Guard, about 10,000 strong, a division that looks after the presidency and protects the presidency. But then the leadership of the military and most of the divisions, also Alawite. The Mukhabarat, or the Secret Service, has many branches. They're all led by Alawites, or most of them are. But this makes it so difficult to have regime change, because in many ways it's like Iraq. If you're going to change the regime in Syria, somehow you've got to get the security forces to separate from the president, which is very hard. That's what happened in Egypt and Tunisia. The militaries turned their backs on the president, and he was forced to resign. In Syria, that's not happened. The military stayed loyal. So if this opposition is going to ever win, they would have to overcome the military somehow, or else cause the military to split and Sunnis to leave the Alawites. And if there is regime change, the Ba'ath Party, and Syria has a Ba'ath Party like Iraq did, that would be dissolved. Military superstructure disbanded. Probably the military would crumble. And so there would be a major purge. Possibly up to 2 million people would lose their jobs. So they're not going to give up. This would be civil war. The Sunni business elite doesn't want civil war. That would destroy their businesses. So they've remained loyal. That's why this protest movement that's been raging today, and particularly young Syrians, many who don't have jobs or very good prospects for the future, want to get rid of this regime. And they see corruption. They see lack of freedom. But it's going to be very difficult.
And so, as you laid out for us, the ethnic disparity between the Alawites and the majority Sunni is a big piece of Syria and the Syrian population rising up against the Alawite government.
It is, but there's class also, because upper-class Sunnis, the Sunni community is quite split, and a lot of them have refused to come out against the regime. Now, we don't know what's in their hearts, and every Syrian, I think, is very critical of the regime and the people, or the corruption, what they see as stultification. There are many Syrians who like Bashar al-Assad, the president. They see him as a young guy who's tried to do some good things. They're fearful of instability. But, you know, Damascus and Aleppo, the two major cities dominated by Sunnis, have not seen big demonstrations. That's 50% of the population. That's where the middle class and the upper class, those cities have been spoiled by this regime. There have been demonstrations in the suburbs, particularly the poor suburbs, where there's tons of poverty in Syria. 32% of Syrians live under the poverty line, which by UN is $2 a day or less. 50% of Syrians are spending half their income on food alone. And they've been hammered over the last several years because of commodity price hikes. Wheat has gone up 100% in the last 2 years. So Syria is in a very difficult position.
What would your best guess be as to the outcome of this current uprising against the Assad regime? And in your view, what is the importance of the outcome to the region and to the world?
As long as the army remains faithful to this president and to the regime, it'll be very difficult for anybody to overthrow the regime, which is turning out to be quite strong and a tough customer. Even though it's weak in some ways, it is tough militarily. And the opposition is not organized. They don't have a distinct leadership, which is a strength when you don't want to get arrested, but it's a real weakness when you're trying to present a face to the world, to America and France, and to, most importantly, to Syrian people, and particularly the upper middle class, who've got a lot to lose if they join a revolution. They want to know if their property is going to be protected. Who's going to take over? Are these people responsible? Are they a bunch of, you know, lunatics or silly people, or are they too Muslim for them? Are they too non-Muslim? People want to know these things, and they don't know. So the majority of Syrians have remained a sort of silent majority. All want to see deep reforms. Many do not want to see this regime thrown over because they're worried that the opposition will be splintered, that the country could fall into civil war like Iraq. And people don't want to go through that. And so I think that the regime is going to win this round. If this goes on for a long time, the economy is going to really suffer. And that's going to undermine this regime further. And then you could see defections. But none of the Syria's neighbors, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, want to see civil war or real chaos in Syria. So they've been biting their tongues, even though they've made a lot of statements about outrage. They don't want to see this killing stopped. Nobody's really willing to kick the legs out from under this regime because they're really fearful of what might come next. And that has paralyzed America. It's paralyzed Europe. That's why our reaction in Libya is so different from Syria. In many ways, Syria is too big to fail.
That was Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma and editor of the online newsletter Syria Comment. Find links to Landis' articles covering current events in Syria on our website at btlonline.org. The May 1st U.S. Navy SEAL commando raid into Pakistan that killed Osama bin Laden set off an angry backlash among Pakistani government and military officials who were kept in the dark by the White House and Pentagon about the impending assault on the al-Qaeda leader's secret compound. While many Americans have watched and read accounts of this famous incursion into Pakistan, most are unaware that the U.S. and NATO have launched dozens of unmanned Predator drones with guided missiles to attack suspected Taliban guerrillas and terrorist groups in the tribal regions of both Afghanistan and Pakistan. According to the Human Rights Commission of Pakistan, there were 111 U.S.-NATO Predator drone attacks inside Pakistan during 2010, resulting in 957 civilian deaths. The United Nations reports that from 2006 to 2011, an estimated 1,245 civilians have died in U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan. Recent UN reports suggest that the Taliban are responsible for a larger share of civilian deaths in the Afghan war during the past year. Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai, whose cousin was killed in a U.S. night raid in March, has repeatedly condemned U.S. and NATO drone and other airstrikes that have resulted in the deaths of civilians. Between the Lines' Scott Harris spoke with Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. She was among 37 protesters arrested at Hancock Air Force Base in Syracuse, New York, on April 22nd, where the military houses drones and trains operators for missions abroad. Kelly explains why she opposes the use of Predator drones in targeted assassinations in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and other nations.
So many civilians have been killed in the drone attacks. The minimum number over the course of 240 strikes, the minimum number killed has been 1,476, and the maximum, according to other counts, is 2,352, and that's in Pakistan.
That's an incredible number of people. I would guess most Americans are not aware that more than 1,000 people have been killed, civilians, innocent civilians killed by these U.S. and NATO drones.
And I think that maybe people know about the drones because President Obama was able to make a joke about them. Some of your listeners might remember somebody had asked some question about what if anybody, you know, were to make overtures, unwanted overtures toward his daughters, and he said, call in the drones. So people know, but I don't know that people understand what it means for young people to be sleeping in their beds at night and to hear the drone overhead and to know it's getting closer and to wonder, are they going to be the next ones to be attacked? And the tactic of choice now in the war in Afghanistan, and certainly with regard to Pakistan, where the drones are operated by the CIA, the tactics of choice increasingly are these covert methods that we can't know too much about, including the night raids. One general was asked, you know, well, can't you tell people if you take their loved ones away, can't you say who you took and where you took them? And the general said, well, no, you know, we can't be taking time out to draw up a flyer. This is a battle. But I don't buy that because, you know, just two nights ago, anybody in Pakistan or Afghanistan has to know that families in villages sleep outside when it's so beastly hot. They sleep in the courtyards. They don't have electricity. They can't turn on the fan. So, you know, they sleep in the courtyard and hope they catch a whiff of the breeze. And this is very, very common. So when the night raids happen at 1 o'clock in the morning, at 3 o'clock in the morning, U.S., these are like huge warriors that are specially trained. They start their night raid by throwing a grenade in the courtyard. So Niloufer, 12 years old, was killed on May 12th in her sleep. And then they lied about it. They said, well, we saw an individual running out the back, and we believe that individual was a possible insurgent, and so we shot the person. But that's not true. The grenade killed her in her sleep, and this was documented by the New York Times.
Kathy, there's a lot of debate about U.S. policy in Afghanistan and Pakistan at this moment after the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. There are a lot of people in this country who increasingly want the United States to withdraw from Afghanistan. Given that the United States has chosen these unmanned Predator drones as the weapon of choice in these targeted assassinations of suspected jihadist militants in these villages throughout the region, what's the real-world ramifications? What's the blowback for the United States when so many civilians are being killed, deliberately or not? And you could take the Pentagon's word that they're not trying to target civilians, and it only makes sense. But the fact is civilians are being killed, and there's a lot of bad blood, possibly a cultivation of sympathy for these radical Islamist groups as a result.
And the fact is that 49 countries now possess the drone technology, and there are over 250 companies manufacturing different variations of drones. So I think a key word is proliferation. You know, I think that we certainly are creating huge enmity and antagonism, but also many other countries are going to start to say, well, if the United States can use this technology, so can we. And, it, you know, in 1945, only one country had the nuclear bomb, the United States. But now the nuclear club has swelled, and trillions of dollars have been spent by many countries trying to acquire the nuclear bomb, and that's money taken from what could have been spent to alleviate world poverty and hunger and disease. So that's the reality that emerged out of World War II. Well, this drone technology isn't all that difficult to replicate. And what's to stop a rogue group, a non-state entity, from going into an area of the United States that's not very noticeable to observers, that's kind of a covert spot, and being able to create a runway. And once you've got that drone airborne, then it can be operated by somebody completely on the other side of the world. Is that the kind of world we want to develop? And now they're talking about drones that are the size of hummingbirds and swarms of drones that act simultaneously. And the ways in which this technology will advance are it's like the Lady Gaga of the industry. I mean, it's certain that the United States is going to be pushing a technology that will be picked up all around the world, and robotized warfare will be part of our future.
That was Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Learn more about her group and organized opposition to the use of unmanned Predator drones by visiting our website at btlonline.org. Record-setting weather events, vast floods along the Mississippi River, and shockingly destructive tornadoes in the South have dominated the news in the U.S. for the past several weeks. Up to now, climate scientists have always been careful to say that no particular weather event can be linked directly to climate change. But many climate experts are now linking climate change directly to some of these weather-related disasters. Dr. Kevin Trenbert is head of the Climate Analysis Section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado, funded by the National Science Foundation. In an April interview, Dr. Trenbert said he believes it is irresponsible not to mention climate change in the context of these extreme tornadoes, and added that the scientific community is still trying to understand how polluting our atmosphere with billions of tons of greenhouse gases affects tornadic activity. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Dr. Trenbert, one of the world's top climate scientists, who explains the cause and effect relationship between climate change and extreme weather events, and suggests this information would be valuable for political leaders to take into consideration when voting on environment and climate change legislation.
The key thing is that the environment in which all of these storms is occurring now is simply different than it was, say, 30 years ago. The global warming aspects from human activities really kicked in about the 1970s, and so one of the things I like to do is to compare the situation now with the conditions, you know, prior to, say, about the 1970s. And what has happened is that the planet has warmed. It's warmed by, 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit as a whole. And going along with that, there is more water vapor in the atmosphere over the oceans. For every 1 degree Fahrenheit increase in temperature, there's about a 4% increase in water vapor. And so all of the storms that are forming now are in a different environment where the surface air is potentially warmer and moister and therefore more buoyant. It can trigger thunderstorms, and it certainly provides more moisture for all of the storms that are then forming. And so it plays a role in any of these storms that get sufficiently organized that they can tap into this moisture and potentially lead to heavy rains and flooding, as we've seen.
Isn't the flooding we're talking about now on the Mississippi River, is that just related to storm activity, or isn't that related to snowmelt? And doesn't this happen at this time every year?
Well, both, yes. In fact, we have two things that normally happen at this time of year. One of them is that we've got snow melt, and the Mississippi Basin is huge, and there are large areas, especially in the north, where there's a lot of snow cover that's melting that's helping to feed the Missouri and the Mississippi and the other rivers that flow into the Mississippi. And then the other thing that happens is in springtime, we get a lot of storms tracking across the country. They tend to track right through the middle of the country, somewhere like that. And under certain circumstances, they are in a position where they can tap into tremendous amounts of moisture out of the Gulf of Mexico, which is one of the factors that occurred this time around. And one of the consequences then can be quite severe storms, tornadic storms, and heavy rains.
Kevin Trenbert, it seems like sometimes when these disasters happen, you know, people say there's never been anything like this. But then if you look at the record, maybe there has. So are you saying, according to actual meteorological records, that these things are happening at greater frequency and or at greater strength?
This is is certainly true in the U.S. as a whole. If we look at the statistics, we find that the very heavy rains are increasing at a substantial rate. In general, it has become wetter in the United States, especially east of the Rockies. But the biggest increases have been for the very heavy events. For the 20th century, and this is mainly since about 1970, there was a 7% increase in moisture for the lower 48 contiguous states, but a 20% increase in the top 1% of heavy rainfall events. So this is generally symptomatic of what's going on. When it rains harder than it used to. And so we have events like the 1993 floods in the Mississippi. This was centered up around Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And then they had, 15 years later, another set of floods. Both of those sets of floods were supposedly 500-year floods. And so as a general rule of thumb, what used to be a 500-year flood is now becoming, I don't know, a 70- or 50-year flood, and a 100-year flood is becoming a 30-year flood or something like that. So all of the statistics are being jerked in the direction where what used to be a relatively rare event at the time when, say, all of the levees and a lot of the water management systems around the country were being planned are no longer as rare. And so the planning that was done by the Corps of Engineers and other groups has not factored in the climate change into the risk of some of the flooding that is occurring now.
Is this the kind of information that you hope politicians would take and try to address the issue of climate change?
I would hope so. I mean, it's very strange because, ironically, many of the states that have been most affected by the flooding and the tornadoes have representatives in the Congress who have voted against legislation relating to climate change, such as the legislation affecting the EPA and their ability to regulate greenhouse gases. So I think these legislators should be asking questions. You know, why is this happening? Why are we breaking records? And you can't simply blame this all on natural variability. Natural variability is certainly playing a role, but equally climate change that us humans have something to do with is also playing a role.
That was Kevin Trenbert, distinguished senior scientist at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. For more information on the relationship between severe weather and climate change, visit our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.